From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. We're very grateful for every one of you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, February 7th marks the Interfaith Four Chaplains Sunday, as well as the Christian Feast of the Transfiguration. Monday brings the Chinese New Year, as celebrated in the Confucian, Taoist, and Buddhist traditions. And February 10th is Ash Wednesday, the start of the Christian observance of Lent, leading up, of course, to Easter Sunday. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, a new report attributes as many as 32 youth suicides to the Mormon Church's recent hardline stand on LGBT persons and families, which brands as apostates Mormons in a same-gender marriage. Nominees for the Nobel Peace Prize have been announced, and they include Greek refugee workers, the German Chancellor, Pope Francis, the survivors of last year's mass shooting at Charleston's Emmanuel AME Church, and, yes, Donald Trump. A new Pew survey offered a somewhat encouraging look at the state of religious pluralism in the nation. Despite loud and heated anti-Islamic rhetoric, a majority of Americans reject the idea that a religion can be blamed for violence. Rand Paul surprised everyone by quitting the presidential race, perhaps realizing that if they're not welcome in Iowa, they won't be welcome anywhere. Two famously religious-driven candidates, Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee, also dropped out this week, with Huckabee finally saying something inarguably true. Quote, "The voters are sick of me." And Heisman Trophy winner Derrick Henry offered the closing prayer at this year's National Prayer Breakfast on Thursday. The president was there in a tradition dating back to 1953 and problematic due to its deeply sectarian nature. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
Ted Cruz remains in the lead. Donald Trump in second. Marco Rubio in third.
On the Democratic side, also a close race. You have Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders head-to-head.
This past week brought a surprising second-place caucus finish in Iowa for GOP presidential frontrunner Donald Trump, and remarkably close numbers for the top leading Democratic candidates. We'll analyze the state of the race later in this hour when I'm joined by political analyst Greg LaBelle.
We have to respond to social challenges as interconnected with one another and joined together as part of one movement for justice and change.
Extraordinarily important work is being done every day at Auburn Theological Seminary in New York City. In areas of engagement around social justice issues, education for the 21st century, and innovative community building, Auburn excels at discovering new and effective ways to connect and inspire. On this week's show, we'll catch up with Auburn President Catherine Henderson and Senior Vice President for Public Engagement Paul Rauschenbusch. But first,
more than 100 countries were represented at a gathering in Morocco this week. It had one focus, the plight of religious minorities in Muslim lands.
History was made late last month when over 250 Muslim religious leaders, heads of state and scholars, along with interfaith allies, gathered in Morocco to address the mistreatment of religious minorities in majority Muslim countries. Groundbreaking both for the diversity of its participants and for the resulting document, the Marrakesh Declaration, this event deserves our attention. And joining me right now is one of the leaders in attendance at that gathering, Imam Mohammed Majid. Imam Majid, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thank you so much for inviting me on.
Start, please, by briefly describing the origins of this important meeting and tell us a little bit about the scope of the leaders that took part.
This process has started 3 years ago, where we decided to respond to news that coming from Muslim countries, where Christians and other religious minorities being mistreated, the place of worship being attacked. And we said we'd like to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And our mosque here at Adams Center helped to rebuild two churches in Pakistan mm-hmm. by having a fundraising and donated the money for rehabilitation and rebuilding of those two churches was burned down. Mm-hmm. Then we said we need to take it further than that. We need to make sure we have programs to prevent this kind of type of attack on religious minorities by having the Muslim scholars gather together to address this issue. Mm-hmm. So we started a series of conferences. We started with Georgetown University. Then we took another conference to Mauritania, mm-hmm. then to Tunisia. And we always thought that the final conference will be in Morocco. Mm-hmm. And well-known leading Muslim scholars in the world, Sheikh Abdullah bin Bayya, took this upon himself, and he's the one who led all of these conferences from Georgetown, Mauritania, Tunisia. And now his center in Abu Dhabi, called the Center of Promoting Peace in Muslim Countries or Muslim Communities, have co-sponsored this with the Moroccan government. Mm-hmm. The whole idea was to get a declaration where we can be used in crafting laws, curriculum, media campaign in addressing the rights of the citizens of other faiths mm-hmm. in the majority Muslim countries.
Yeah. Imam, I'm curious about who was missing that should have been there that would have made it even a more holistic declaration.
In terms of scholarship, I think the scholars that were there, they were really represented a very wide group of people from Saudi Arabia to Jordan and all of the, even people come from Russia, Muslim scholars. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it is represented what I call it the level of a scholarship mm-hmm. that's necessary to address this issue. Mm-hmm. But what is missing, which is the second phase, which is the implementation. We have to get people who get the masses of Muslims to listen to them to take this declaration to the next level. Mm-hmm. As you know, that you have scholars who might be highly respected in the scholarship, but don't have the popularities sometimes in the grassroots. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we need to have the social media people, mm-hmm. that people who have maybe millions of followers in their Facebook, mm-hmm. who I call them the online preachers. Mm-hmm. We need to have those to be part of this campaign. That's why we are not stopping at the point of issuing a declaration, but we're taking it to the next level. Yeah. Where we're going to take it to the different regions around the world, and we will have roundtable discussions, but at the same time, media strategy and speaking to educators and education departments in majority Muslim countries mm-hmm. to bring this declaration to the grassroots level by implementing it in the curriculum of the schools.
Mm-hmm. There really is not another document like this. I mean, there's been some really great conferences and documents produced, like A Common Word and what was done around that. But this is addressing a whole new area, and I don't think there's another thing like this, is there?
Yes. This is a unique document, and one of the good things that happened during the conference itself, we had people from other faiths, Christian and Jewish and Yazidis and the Ahmadiyyas and all the minorities, whether within Islam or out of Islam, we have Shia communities. Mm-hmm. They come together and said, this is really historical. This is unique.
Right.
And that's why the Marrakesh Declaration considered like a turning point, in mm-hmm. my opinion, in the relationship between Muslim and people of other faiths in the majority Muslim countries. Mm-hmm. Because it's one thing to have dialogue, which is a very important cornerstone or steps to build this relationship to the extent that you can come with such a declaration. Mm-hmm. But there's another thing that when you come with very clear understanding of what the nature of the relationship should look like. Mm-hmm. And that's what we saw this in this declaration.
Mohammed, what do our listeners need to know about the Marrakesh Declaration? Just hit some of the major points in which they'd be interested.
The declaration addressed the issue of citizenship, that no person should be discriminated against because of his faith or her faith, that they have to have equal rights as citizens. Addressing the issue of misinterpretation of Islam to try to use text to exclude people of other faiths from the public square. Mm-hmm. It addressed and acknowledged the atrocities being committed against minorities in the majority Muslim countries, and calls in very strong term that those people who are of other faith, that have been there for centuries, they are part of the social fabric of those communities, and there's no one have a right to try to push them away and exclude them. Mm-hmm. And also it addressed the issue of what we call Charter of Medina. Medina is a city where the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, established the first community. Mm-hmm. For this whole document, it was based on that Charter of Medina, where the Prophet Muhammad has an agreement with people of other faith in Medina to live all of them in peace. Mm-hmm. And give full rights to the Jewish community and people of other faith living in communities of Medina. Therefore, the declaration is based on that charter.
I see. How can our listeners find out more about the Marrakesh Declaration and ways to participate in the work related to it?
There's a website, and also that you can go to the Center of Promoting Peace in Muslim Communities website. Mm-hmm. You can come to IIPC, International Interfaith Peace Corps website, and we will update the progress that we are making in implementation and on those websites.
Mohammed, this week we saw President Obama pay his first visit to an American mosque. I'd like to hear you talk briefly about the significance of this act to the Muslim American community.
I was there listening to the president. Every person in that room felt a sense of pride, of comfort, felt a sense of uplifting. The speech addressed all the issue of concerns, mm-hmm, to the American Muslims and to the American public. It talks about the issue of the Muslim identity. Who are the Muslims? Mm-hmm. And give confidence to young people. Says you don't have to choose. You don't have to second guess whether you belong here or not. You do belong here. And he said, as the president, will do everything in his power to make sure that that understanding be the case in the United States. Mm-hmm. The most beautiful things that the president have quoted founding fathers, which is a reminder to all of us Americans, mm-hmm, living in this beautiful country, that the ideal in which this country was established is religious freedom for all. And whoever would like to promote other than this, he is going against the principles of our founding fathers. This was a great joy to listen to the president. And it was wonderful having him to speak to the young people also. He went to spoke to the children. And I'm very happy that my own daughter was participating in the program, coming out feeling really the president have addressed the issue of the concern of young people. Mm-hmm. And by the way, she was wearing an American flag as a scarf. and she did the Pledge of Allegiance with the scouting. Well, it was very uplifting. It was a moment of being proud to be American Muslims.
Oh, yeah. Imam Mohammed Majid serves as executive director of the All Dulles Area Muslim Society, and he has been a leading voice for interreligious cooperation for all of the years. It's been my pleasure to work closely with him. Imam Majid, I thank you so much for making time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, my friend.
longtime listeners to State of Belief know of the close relationship between this show and Auburn Theological Seminary in New York City. Even as we have for years regularly highlighted the bold work taking place at this venerable institution, Auburn's leaders affirmed the role of State of Belief Radio in our nation's public discourse by supporting us through a time when otherwise we might have been silenced. Now, with the Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch, who has actually guest-hosted this show during his tenure as executive religion editor at the Huffington Post, joining Auburn as senior vice president for public engagement, it just seemed like a perfect time to catch up on what's on the front burner at Auburn. And so I am delighted to welcome back Auburn Seminary President, the Reverend Dr. Catherine Henderson, as well as the Reverend Paul Rauschenbusch.
Well, hello, Wilton. We are thrilled to be here with you today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Catherine, you've done so much to drive civil discourse on the most important issues of our time, equipping leaders with the skills to communicate a progressive, inclusive vision. I suspect you can identify areas where your work has had a demonstrably positive influence.
We are in a season right now where we are really seeing evidence of a different kind of America aborning, an inclusive America, and we're a part of that. So the very exciting thing that happened yesterday is that we were right up there near the top on the Upworthy website with a project that we've been working on for several months now. And in response to some of the rhetoric that we heard from candidates, particularly about Muslims and closing immigration to Muslims and all of that that was coming out in this political season, we had our senior fellows here at Auburn get together, and they put together a letter in support of American Muslims. And it was really a love letter to Muslim communities here. And we got 25,000 or so signatures. I think that's now up to 28,000 now, 8,000 faith leaders. These would be Christians, Jews, Muslims, Sikhs, and others all across the country who signed on to this letter. And then we had about 1,000 people who offered and volunteered to take those letters of support and present them to the mosque or Muslim community in their local areas. And so we've had a number of deliveries of these letters. What we're trying to do and what a lot of people are trying to do is to create a different kind of narrative and to highlight the other kinds of stories about neighbors caring for neighbor all over the country.
Oh, great story. Paul, your work at Huffington Post Religion was simply invaluable to so many of us. At the same time, you have a deep academic background as well, including your time as associate dean at Princeton. What drew you to Auburn Seminary?
Well, I had known of Auburn for as long as I've been involved in the kind of higher education and theological world. I went to Union, and Auburn was housed there, and I've known wonderful people who have worked at Auburn. And recently, from my post at Huffington, I could see that there were many actions that, you know, once I saw who was behind them, I was like, oh, it's Auburn again. this is an institution that is engaged in the questions that are facing the world from a deep spiritual reflective place. I was covering for Huffington this huge environmental march, and I'm watching various faith groups come walking down, and then all of a sudden this huge arc comes down the street, and who's in it but Auburn Seminary and friends. And I thought, of course, that's the kind of presence that, you know, makes you stand up and notice. So when I was beginning to think, like, what's next for me, I knew I wanted to be in a place that took faith seriously, that took the need for a faith that applies itself to the world seriously, and also a place that did research. So one of the great things about being at Auburn is that it's not just me saying, well, I think this might work. Mm-hmm. We have the whole research area that really looks at what works.
What's the role of an institution such as Auburn Seminary in an election cycle? A lot of your key social justice issues are in the spotlight.
I mean, we need to be deeply involved in how we shape our life together. And that gets into the political arena. Mm-hmm. It gets into issues of policy. And people of faith need to be very cognizant of not just how God loves me, mm-hmm. but how God wants us to construct our life together. Mm-hmm. And what are the policies that are going to allow us to create an environment of human flourishing for all of God's children? How are we going to enact care for the poor and the disenfranchised and those who don't usually have a voice? We did a study, Welton, through Auburn Research on money in politics, where we asked theologians to think about, and these were evangelicals and progressive Christians and Catholics and Jews, to think about Citizens United and how the undue influence of money in politics is antithetical to our religious values. The research question was, do our religious traditions, do our sacred texts have anything to say about money in politics? And in fact, our texts do, our traditions do. Mm-hmm. And the study that came out of that was called Losing Faith in Our Democracy. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is what we're experiencing a lot these days with the voting public, who are really losing faith in the democratic process. And so I think that, you know, as faith leaders, we need to help re-engage people and help them to understand that politics is this way of organizing our shared life together, organizing the public space, and that as people of faith, we have to be engaged. And there's a lot that can be done that doesn't cross any kind of lines institutionally.
Paul, what during your time at Huffington Post Religion did you experience, did you observe that you now want to use in strengthening what you're doing at Auburn Seminary?
There's so much that I am taking from Huffington Post, but also from Princeton, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. A lot of what I did at Princeton was convene opportunities for people to engage one another in important conversations. And Auburn is great at that. What I was doing at Huffington was something very similar, but it was online. Mm-hmm. My effort at Huffington Post was to create a space online for productive, pluralistic, positive conversations about religion that offered new ideas, that offered voice to people who often had not been heard in the public square. And we are doing that actually as we speak here at Auburn. I mean, one of the cool new initiatives that Catherine and I and the entire staff is engaged in is actually launching something that will be called Auburn Voices, which will be an opportunity for people to be heard using Auburn's platform. And that will happen mostly online. And I'm going to be really using all of my skills from Huffington Post to help curate. And we will look for the best ideas online. And what we're trying to do is create an impact in the digital world, because anybody who spends any time online knows that that is a locus for the best and the worst of humanity. And what we want to do is help raise those who are working for good and raise those voices and promote them in any way we can. So Auburn is going to be making a major push towards digital impact. And this is very exciting and extremely needed. I don't need to tell you, but ISIS, you know, to use an extreme example, has 50,000 Twitter handles that it uses to promote hate and violence. And we have this example in other religious communities as well. There is extraordinary and unbridled extremism on the web that is geared towards destruction of other. And what we want to be is a place as potent and as powerful with a message of love and a message of prophetic coming together for a true kingdom of God. And we encourage people to follow us on Twitter, Auburn Seminary. Follow us on Facebook. We're going to be starting up with Instagram, Pinterest, Snapchat. So we're really viewing this as an extension of everything we believe in, but really making a major move into the digital space.
Wow.
This is something that I do bring, but what I'm also encountering here, and this is the reason I came to Auburn, I knew half of the staff here from my other lives that I've done in religion, and they're the most extraordinary people. I mean, I want to lift up one example of a colleague of mine who actually was my tutor in systematic theology at Union when I first arrived and didn't know anything. Her name is Lisa Anderson, and she has a cohort. It's called the Sojourner Truth Leadership Circle. And she brought together women of color of faith who were working together not only to create a prophetic movement for that community and by that community, but also looking at self-care and resilience for people who are doing this very hard work of organizing and working for justice. It actually can really tear at you because you experience a lot of grief and hate in doing that work. Lisa Anderson is doing that, and her next cohort is all going to be trans women of faith of color, located in Atlanta. This is the kind of thing that Auburn is doing that is no one else is doing. It is so radical, so important. So when I talk about being excited about what I'm doing, the real reason I'm excited about what I'm doing is because I get to work with incredible colleagues across the board, and that's just one example.
Catherine, I do want to ask, what are you concerned about? What do you stay awake at night sometimes and think about, the challenges you face? Talk about that for a second, and then talk about what you're excited about right now.
Well, I think there's so many things in the world that keep all of us awake. I have deep concerns about the future of our country as I look at this election season. And in my life experience, I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like this in terms of the rancor. I think that one of our biggest challenges right now is to work really hard to create the kind of democracy and spirit of community and caring for one another and caring for our neighbors and diversity that our country was founded on. Yeah. And, you know, as people of faith and moral courage, we have got to take our country back.
to use a well-worn phrase by one of our colleagues on the...
On maybe a different side. But we really do, because the fabric of this country, you know, was built on diversity of religions and people from all over the world, and that will be what will save us in the end here. So I think one other piece of excitement is the work that we're doing with our senior fellows, and these are some of the most visible faith leaders in the country, Otis Moss III at Trinity UCC in Chicago, the Reverend Dr. William Barber of Morrow Mondays in North Carolina, Rabbi Sharon Brouse in L.A., who founded a very exciting synagogue and congregation called ICAR. So some of the most entrepreneurial, visible faith leaders who not only focus on their own congregations, but who are really trying to build the kind of public square that we have been talking about on this program. And to work with this level of faith leader is thrilling and very representative. I mean, they are Christians, Jews, Muslims, Sikhs. We are daily thrilled by the kind of work that they are doing together, not just in their individual spaces, but how they are working together to understand each other's theology and, and sacred texts and understand how our traditions shape our life together, and how our traditions can be exactly what we need in this moment of great challenge in our country. So working with the senior fellows is a thrill for us.
And, you know, I'm so glad. Everybody you mentioned has been a guest on State of Belief Radio and more than once, and we're all working together, and that feels very, very good. The Reverend Dr. Catherine Henderson is president of Auburn Theological Seminary in New York City. The Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch has recently joined Auburn in the role of senior vice president for public engagement. Catherine, Paul, I really hope we can do this again soon. In the meantime, though, thank you both for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having us.
Welcome.
The Iowa caucuses always generate plenty of headlines as the way too long buildup to our electoral cycle is replaced by the actual way too long electoral cycle. But even in light of that history, some of last week's events in Iowa managed to raise eyebrows. For a look at those events and what they may portend for the weeks ahead, I'm delighted to be joined once again by Greg LaBelle, a man who's lived through this brutal process and lived to tell about it. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It's great to talk with you as well, Welton.
Is Iowa that important?
It's a real good question. 4 years ago, Iowa's reputation took a beating when they falsely announced that Mitt Romney had won the caucuses and they had to backtrack and award them to Santorum. We will be able to better answer that question once we get a little bit further down the line and see how many of these folks who did well or surprisingly well in Iowa do. Its importance may be a little bit on the wane. Of course, I have to make sure that I mention that, in fact, I did grow up in New Hampshire and cut my teeth on New Hampshire presidential politics, so I'm probably slightly biased there.
Yeah. Well, was there one thing about the Iowa caucuses this year that stood out for you as the most remarkable?
Yeah, I think that the closeness on the Democratic side, I mean, I think that couple of tenths of a percentage point on the Democratic side was certainly unusual. It's never happened before. It's the closest race that's ever been recorded in the Iowa caucuses. That was surprising. And, you know, it's interesting because the angle that we look at is Iowa's all about organization. And of the two candidates, Clinton and Sanders, Clinton definitely had the edge on organization. In 2008, when Obama beat Clinton, he had a superb organization as well as a great deal of enthusiasm. This time we had Sanders' enthusiasm up against Clinton organization. And those two things came to a virtual tie.
When you say you were surprised that it was close because you expected Clinton to win.
Yeah, I was surprised that it was as close as it was. Obviously, she did win, but I thought it would be by a little bit wider margin than what they came up with. The enthusiasm gap between Clinton and Sanders was enough to really drive those Sanders voters out. And it's really interesting when we look at sort of who some of those people were. What we saw most definitely in Iowa is there is an age gap. And I think it sort of jumped out at me mostly when I looked at some of the numbers of people who participated. We look at the difference in people's responses to what's important to them as they're going into the caucuses. And among married women, the gap between Sanders and Clinton, with Clinton ahead, was 26 percentage points. Mm. Among unmarried women, Sanders was ahead by 10 percentage points. That's quite a remarkable difference. I think the other thing that struck me was how heavily weighted towards Sanders' independence or no-party registration were. He was on top of a 43-point gap, and these tend to be younger people. There's a generational gap here that that Clinton is struggling with right now, and I think it was really very obvious in what happened in the Democratic caucuses out there.
So you were surprised on the Democratic side. Were you surprised on the Republican side? Did Cruz beating Trump surprise you?
Yeah, I have to say yes, because it did look like Trump had enough of a lead to pull it off. I thought it would be close, but I thought that Trump would probably pull that off. Cruz had a very strong organization on the ground, and I guess in one sense, I thought Cruz would do very well. It was surprising to me that he beat him by much. And I guess the other thing is that Marco Rubio almost unseated Trump from second place. He was sort of playing the leftover role, in a sense. I think people who got to the caucuses and realized for various reasons that they weren't going to be able to support either Trump or Cruz, many, many of them seemed to settle on Rubio, and it left everybody, all those other candidates, in the dust. It amazes me that Marco Rubio is now being described as the candidate of the establishment in this party. This guy was the Tea Party darling when he was elected to the Senate. and now he's being presented as the establishment candidate. I'm not quite sure how that happened, but I think that Donald Trump and his popularity had a lot to do with moving that perception considerably off to the right.
I think what Cruz did was wrong, and I don't understand why more people are not criticizing it.
Yeah, there are two issues there with the Cruz campaign. One is the reports that some of his organizers in the caucuses misinterpreted, either intentionally or unintentionally, a CNN report that Dr. Carson was going back to Florida for a change of clothes.
Yeah.
and was telling their folks in the caucuses that Carson was dropping out and they may as well come and caucus with Cruz. And the other is that mailing that they did the week before, which was basically a public shaming mailing that basically listed the name of the recipient and the recipient's neighbors, indicating whether or not they were regular voters. Both of those things are certainly ethically questionable.
Why is there not protest about it?
It's a good question. I think maybe it gets back to what we've been hearing about how just the American public expects so little of its political process right now that nobody's particularly surprised, which is a terribly sad commentary on where we are. Trump is saying, they got to rerun the election. Well, of course, that's not going to happen.
No.
But I fear that folks are just so fed up with politics that they're just not surprised.
Greg, 64% of Republican caucus goers were estimated to be evangelical Christians. Is there any other state that even comes close to that kind of percentage?
I suspect not. I know that New Hampshire doesn't.
Yes.
I don't think that Ted Cruz, and to a large extent Marco Rubio, can go to New Hampshire without making some significant changes in the way they present themselves to the mm-hmm. electorate. I don't think we'll be hearing quite so much talk about their commitment to Jesus Christ
mm-hmm.
as they're going through the motions in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work there. So there are a few people, obviously, but it's not the kind of language that works well in New Hampshire. So
right.
It'll be really interesting, I think, to watch, particularly how Ted Cruz changes his language, or if he does, and what the result of that is.
How significant is it that Huckabee, Santorum, and Paul have dropped out of the race? Who do you think will be the next to go, and who's going to benefit from who's gone?
It really doesn't make much difference in terms of numbers, because when we look at the Iowa results, after Rubio, everyone else was sort of clustered at the bottom in the single digits and sometimes fairly low single digits. So I think that Santorum's departure has very little impact on this process. I think what will happen in New Hampshire, we will see another winnowing, and I think we'll see possibly one of those also ran, someone who's not Trump, Cruz, or Rubio
mm-hmm.
kind of move up in the list and then become the main challenger, I think, to Rubio as the so-called establishment candidate.
Hmm.
Kasich seems to have been coming on up there in New Hampshire. Doesn't surprise me. He kind of fits the New Hampshire profile.
Mm-hmm.
I think we may see Governor Christie drop out. I think that if Jeb Bush isn't able to break into double digits, I don't know why he would stay around.
Yeah. Well, listen, take off your professorial hat, if you have it on, and put on your old hat of being the manager of a campaign. From a political management perspective, are there campaigns that you see making significant mistakes right now, and what are they?
There have been some mistakes. I actually think that Bernie Sanders is probably making a bit of a mistake right now in harping on a couple of things. I think that he's gotten really hung up on this distinction between progressive and moderate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that most people who are listening to this really care
mm-hmm.
about that issue, so I'm not sure why he keeps sort of hanging on to that. Now, maybe he sees it as a way to drive up his base support, but I don't see it. Clinton obviously has made more than her share of mistakes over time. I have to say that last night, for the first time in a long time, I saw her really come into her own. I thought she was thoughtful. I thought she allowed us to get a fuller sense of who she is in some of her answers, which sort of lines up with what we know about Hillary Clinton. I mean, she tends to do best when her back is against the wall. Look at New Hampshire in 2008 when she came back and beat Barack Obama. Look at her at the Benghazi hearings. I mean, this seems to be when she's at her best. I think the trick is for the campaign to keep her convinced that her back is against the wall, and she just seems to be better. I suspect that Trump probably ended up making a mistake by skipping that debate. It may have hurt him. I think a lot of people kind of looked at him and began to recognize that this guy is kind of a big baby, and that peeled some support away from him in Iowa. And that may continue in New Hampshire. He's got a commanding lead right now. Real Clear Politics puts the average at about 20 points. Mm-hmm. I'd frankly be surprised if he ends up winning by that much. I think some of the flaws are really beginning to show. People are starting to get a little bit tired of Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. What should we be keeping our eyes open so that we don't miss in the next 2 or 3 weeks?
Post-New Hampshire, on the Republican side, for all intents and purposes, will probably be down to a four-person race. I suspect that Cruz won't do nearly as well as he did in Iowa, but I imagine he'll still be in the mix, and I think it's going to be in some order Trump, Cruz, Rubio, and one of those also-rans. Mm-hmm. And as we head off to South Carolina, of course, then we're back into that conservative Christian arena. And so I think we will see on that side candidates begin to sort of make that shift back to the language that we saw in Iowa, which does seem to play better down there.
So the Democrats stay close?
Probably, yes. I think that Clinton, you know, she's decided she's going to compete in New Hampshire, and I think part of it is emotional. I think she feels that New Hampshire has been good to her, but I also think they feel that strategically they can't afford to walk away from it after the closeness of Iowa, so they're going to stay. What they have to hope to do in Iowa, I think, is narrow that gap between her and Sanders, which is fairly wide at this point, but it's about 18 points, I think, by most polls. So, you know, if she can cut that in half, she obviously can't claim victory, but she can pull the old Bill Clinton comeback kid thing if she wants in New Hampshire. If she cuts it by more than 9 points, I think it says a lot, particularly since, you know, this is Bernie Sanders' backyard, and there's been such a strong level of support for him there for so long. South Carolina and Nevada should be very good for her, because another thing we saw in Iowa is that Sanders' support still tends to be really white and really rural. And that begins to change as we move out of New England for a while and we look at South Carolina and Nevada. So Sanders, the appeal will be somewhat diminished, I think. As from what I can tell, the organization as well. I don't think he's had the time or money to build the organization in these post-Iowa, New Hampshire states that he would need to build. So I think we'll begin to see some real shifts. In fact, we may see Bernie Sanders begin to fade from view.
Greg LaBelle is Assistant Professor of Political Management at George Washington University, where he is the Director of the Semester in Washington Politics Program. A veteran of several presidential campaigns over the years, Greg has also served in several leadership roles at Interfaith Alliance. Greg, it's just the beginning. I'm glad we can benefit from your expertise and your sense of humor here on State of Belief Radio, and I look forward to the next time.
I'm looking forward to it, Welton. Thank you.
Before we go, there's always the risk when discussing values and morality of veering into judgmentalism. That's certainly not my intent. I've tried to stay away from that all of my life. At the same time, it's impossible to talk about the forces driving this year's electoral cycle without referring to the fact that several presidential campaigns are constructed out of the language of morality. Democrats, the argument on the right goes, have subverted the greatness of America and sold out to godless liberal heathens, abandoning God and his wishes for his nation in the process. It's an effective piece of rhetoric for a certain part of the electorate, but it sounds particularly hollow in the context of this week's goings-on in Iowa. Among Republican caucus-goers, estimates are that up to 64% identified as evangelical Christians, the prime target of values voters rhetoric. And yet, their top choice, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who was generous with the God talk, and earned a number of prominent religious right endorsements ahead of last Monday, has been exposed as the likely beneficiary of campaign dirty tricks. Sure, spreading the word that your chief evangelical-friendly opponent is dropping out of the race isn't a sin on the level of loving someone of the wrong gender, but still, that's what the Cruz campaign did to Ben Carson. Once the damage was done, Cruz issued a sort of apology. But even that statement twisted the truth. A deliberate misreading of a Carson campaign statement was widely disseminated well after the statement itself had already been clarified. And of course, the damage had already been done. And that's what's so hard to swallow. Campaigning on brutal indictments of opponents in terms of morality and values, a candidate is exposed as probably having gained votes with a lie. Forced to apologize, he does so with demonstrable dishonesty. And yet, where are the consequences? Where is even the criticism? Look, I encourage all voters to vote their values. It's an integral part of the political process, and that's true whether your values involve immigration policy, environmental issues, or opposition to abortion and marriage equality. But there is a vitally important line that's crossed once the implicit message is, we're on God's side and the Democrats aren't. As this campaign year continues to heat up, I can only once again issue the warning that ironically came from religious right figure Gene Carlson. When you mix politics and religion, Carlson said, you get politics. And a blind pursuit of so-called religiously inspired political leadership invites the kind of disappointment that a more reasoned analysis, or sometimes even a superficial glance, would help to avoid. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes and an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that has grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online, too. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. It's crazy, and you know it, and I know it, and we're going to keep up with it and try to make some sense out of it. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was.